This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and has 100% promised to say the word Patreon like we mean it. I'm Kevin Day and here's Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Sadly, we are still recording remotely because lockdown may have eased, but the Baroness still doesn't want me in her garden, apparently.
That can be read in so many ways, Kevin.
As I said it, I just realised it sounded like a euphemism. And also, Kieran and I are both in the middle-aged way, all bunged up today. Hairy nostrils are all bunged up, so it's probably best that we are still remote, Kieran. It's news day. Wigan fans, prepare to breathe out in about two stories' time. But first, Kieran, that interview we did with Martin Sowell on our last pod, director of Chippenham Town FC, about the National League fining teams for not fulfilling fixtures, was never going to be the last word on the subject, was it?
Well, no. I mean, Martin was an excellent guest.
Yes.
But very soon afterwards, and he had sort of hinted that things might be developing, there was a proposal from Maidstone United and Dorking Wanderers. Yeah. that there should be a vote of no confidence in both the board and Brian Barwick, who's the chair. Now, as you would expect in an organisation such as the National League, we now have to go through the small print. In order for that vote, first of all, to take place, they've got to be able to call an emergency general meeting. Yep. So for that, they need 10% of the total votes. Now, the National League normally has 24 clubs, but as they inherited from the EFL a club that had just gone bust in the form of Macclesfield Town, that drops to 23. Yeah. National League North and National League South have four votes each. Now, whether they vote sort of en bloc is sort of in a similar way to the Trade Union Congress used to do in terms of the Labour Party, I'm not quite sure, or whether it's sort of on a pro-rata basis, we'll have to find that out. But if they get 10% of the votes, then they go to hold the vote itself. And they need 75% to pass the motion, i.e. they need 24 votes out of 31. Or another way to think of it, you need seven clubs to say, well, actually, we're quite happy with the board. And remember, we've got people from individual clubs in the National League who are on the board. So are they going to vote for a vote of no confidence? We're not so certain. But there's clear dissatisfaction with the present position. Producer Guy has emailed the National League. You know, we wanted to give them a right of reply. We have tried to cover this story as equitably as we can, but we end up running one side of the story because they don't want to talk.
Yeah, which always makes you a little bit suspicious because, as Martin Sowell pointed out, I'm not Jeremy Paxman, and neither are you. We genuinely want to hear the other side of the story, because otherwise it makes us look like we're partisan, and we sort of are, because we know more about one side of the story than another. If there is an EGM and if there is a vote of no confidence, what does that mean in practical terms, Kieran? Does it actually mean that the board will have to change or will have to do something?
Well, if effectively the shareholders of an organisation have no faith in the management, then the management really have no other place to go apart from to resign. Although, looking at things on a broader sphere in society today, it does appear that if you just brazen things out, nobody everybody just shrugs and moves on to the next subject, which I don't think will necessarily be in the best interests of the National League. It's very difficult to have any credibility if you've taken a big vote of no confidence. And even, the worst case scenario is if between 50 and 75% of people vote in favour of no confidence, the board, the vote isn't carried, but at the same time, you know that you're not popular.
Yeah, but also the National League are doing that kind of innocent whistling thing and saying, well, it wasn't us, it was an independent panel. So why are you upset with us? I don't know. And they're also, in that kind of way, sometimes you'll see a 60s gangster film when a low-level mobster will wander up to somebody in the shop and push a vase over and say, oh, what a shame that would be if that got broken. There's some suggestion that the National League have said that if the 16 clubs basically pay the fine and shut up, then they may quietly forget the suspended points deduction. So, but again, without the National League responding to us, we can only report this as conjecture and rumour, which nobody wants, least of all the clubs in the National League. And it does seem, Kieran, as we look at our next story, that life is very confusing for struggling clubs at that level, because Chester were rejected for Sport England emergency funding as they are too well run financially, but Chesterfield were given a £1 million loan.
Yes, this is all to do with the Sport England winter sports package. So the government has put together a £300 million loan package. Now, this is for all sports. So it affects badminton and hockey and lacrosse and all those other sports which don't get a lot of attention, but for the people that play them are still a central part to their life. And I still think are absolutely fantastic as well, because it's part of being British and English. It's sort of that those quirky sports which you do see play, I'll often sort of just stand up. We've got some very strange sports down here in Sussex. one of which is called stall ball, which is not what you think.
Well, what is it? You can't don't leave us. For those of us not luckily enough to live in leafy Sussex, don't leave us hanging. What is stall ball?
It's sort of a cross between rounders and cricket, where there is a wicket, but the wicket is about the size of a laptop screen, and it's 4 foot up in the air, and you bowl underarm, and they try to hit the ball, and the ball's like an American softball or baseball, and you try to hit it in a quadrangle in the same way as baseball, and it's all very jolly, and afterwards we go away for lashings of ginger beer and cucumber sandwiches, as you can imagine.
It's only 40 miles away from here, Kieran, but you're describing a different world. I just love the idea that in Sussex there's a sport that involves throwing a sponge ball at a laptop screen. Also, I love the idea that you describe lacrosse as one of those typically English games, a game that we stole from North American Indians 300 years ago. Anyway, so this winter fund, there's a lot of money. You said it's 300 million quid. There's a lot of money to distribute. So why are clubs like Chester not getting it and Chesterfield are getting it?
Well, it's done on an assessment basis, and I don't think this should. I mean, because sometimes it is being portrayed as Chester versus Chesterfield, but it shouldn't be. I mean, I would say that Chesterfield Football Club have the most detailed accounts of any club in the top six divisions. So, I've always they will tell you how much they actually spend on catering for sandwiches at matches and referees fees. It's really detailed. There's not many people interested, but if anybody that is, take a look at Chesterfield's accounts. CFC 2001 Limited, for those of you already heading to company's house.
Just mention Kieran's name, by the way, you'll get a discount. Yeah. Any historical reasons, Kieran? Sorry to interrupt you, but are there historical reasons for Chesterfield having such detailed accounts?
I know that there isn't. I mean, it's only because I've started, it's only been sort of the last 10 years that I've really sort of started delved into these things with a huge amount. I just think that they've decided to be open with people and that's to be encouraged. And the reason why the loan has been granted is that in the last year or two, they've been losing money. And the purpose of these loans is to try to preserve the existence of clubs. So if it's a sticking plaster, then by all means it works. when we get to Chester, and if you read what's on the Chester Chester FC website, it is a very measured comment. They were rejected because in the view of Sport England, they are not at risk. They are already a sustainable club despite COVID. They've got net no debt. And also, you know, they're in the National League North, which has been abandoned for this season. It has been closed down. Therefore, they've managed to put their staff into furlough. Whereas with Chesterfield, they're in the National League itself, which is progressing. So they've still got players' wages. It's been portrayed at some places is, you know, why are Chesterfield getting it and Chester not getting it? I think there's a case for both clubs potentially getting the money because Chester still have some. Whilst they're not paying out the wages, they've still got ongoing weekly costs, as you do for any business. But that's the way the assessments come in, which seems harsh, you know, given that they have worked so hard. You know, I can remember going to Chester play at the old Sealand Road ground, and then they moved to their new place, and I think they got shafted slightly there because it certainly wasn't, you know, it wasn't as it was originally sold to the fans. It is very much sort of breeze blocks, which is a shame because it's a nice little city, and you know, their rivalry with Wrexham is one of those wonderful things that we've got in this country. The fact that the clock pointing, I don't know if you've heard about this story about the clock at Chester. It's got three faces because it won't point towards Wrexham, even though they've got four sides to the tower. And this is why we love this place. This is why we love the game.
That's brilliant. And when all this is over, anybody who can should visit Chester Racecourse as well, which is, I believe, the smallest racecourse in Europe. It's an amazing sight.
I've been there quite a few times because the Baroness's brother owns quite a few horses.
Really?
So he quite often has them running at Chester, and we go down. And if Chester, when they've got their 3 or 4 day meets at weekends, especially in the summer, the whole of Merseyside decamps, and the sights of people as they are struggling to get back to the station are a view to stay in the memory banks for a long time.
If your brother-in-law, by the way, wants to go into a syndicate with a bloke with no money, just give him my number, won't you? And one final word on this, Kieran. You and the Baroness have got a stallball team, haven't you?
I used to play. I got banned from playing because I could spin the ball, and apparently that's not cricket.
Don't you be coming down here with your elephant and castle ways, spinning the ball, ruining the sport of stallball. And yeah, you'll be bowling into the breeze off the beach in a minute. Now, Wigan fans, we've been both. I think both our voices sound a bit more sexy today, Kieran. Though we've got a hint of cold. Wigan fans, we've been waiting to tell you this for quite some time. Happy Easter! Pour the champagne, get the chocolate ready, because the takeover has been confirmed, Kieran.
Yes, fantastic news. It was confirmed on Tuesday. Things started to drip through because there's a company called Phoenix 2021, which had been formed a couple of months ago. And I'd spotted something at Company's House early yesterday that all of a sudden £3.6 million had mysteriously gone into their bank account, which I can only assume was then used to buy Wigan. It's good news. The club can now move forwards. They've got the Bahraini consortium effectively in charge. I'm going to do a bit of a shout out here that there's two people who are on the board of directors who are ex-students at the University of Liverpool MBA course on football. I will be monitoring them. You know, and they know it. And I think one of them might even be coming on the show to give us a bit more depth as to what's happened in respect of Wigan. But we've got a couple of alumni there, so we're feeling very proud that, you know, all the theory that we've gone through is turning into practice.
You've really scared them now because Kieran's monitoring us. you can't mark them. You sounded like Muttley. That was an evil chuckle. You can't mark them down there. That's very good news. Do you know what, Kieran? That must be a very satisfying feeling for you to know that you've had a small part in that takeover in a way. And I think it's a story that we've covered right from the very start, and I couldn't be more pleased for all those Wigan fans that we've spoken to over the piece, and yeah, we'll get to talk to a couple more of them just for 1 minute, so they can literally tell us how happy they are. But that would be great. But in your opinion, obviously, you know these people, you know two of them. This seems like a proper responsible takeover by a proper responsible group who hopefully will take good care of the club.
Yeah, first of all, they've done their homework. They know what they're buying. The people involved who are on the board, they understand football. So whereas, we need to park the finger pointing at IEC and Al Young. They were never in it for the football. Yeah. Now the people involved clearly do have some form of vision in terms of, first of all, building up the strength of the club, making sure that its assets are properly secure, it's got a strong balance sheet, and then you can start to move to the football side of things.
Yeah, let's hope they've got a bit of spare cash left over, Kieran, to build that statue of the self-aggrandizing administrator we talked about last week. Now, you've been having a look at Bournemouth's figures. I noticed you were social media-ing the arse out of this one because they're not particularly good, are they?
It is, of course, the 31st of March on which we are recording the show. And for those clubs that have got a 30th of June year end, most of them have only got 9 months in which to publish their accounts. So today it's been Bournemouth, Cambridge, Colchester United, Northampton, Pompey, West Brom are putting out bits of theirs. So yeah, it's been a busy day for spreadsheets, to put it mildly. And in respect of Bournemouth, it's probably about as good as can be expected. And when I tell you as good as can be expected is a £75 million loss, I think that shows just how normalised things have become in the Premier League in terms of the impact that COVID had last season. We've now got 12 clubs who have published their accounts, and between them, they've lost £750 million, which is staggering. And those losses are being covered by a combination of player sales and owner investments. And in respect of Bournemouth, trying to get to the real detail as to the background of the owner is difficult because the club is registered in the British Virgin Islands, the parent company. But the owner, who is a Russian billionaire called Maximum Denim, which is a strange name.
Isn't that an aftershave?
If not, I think it should be. I'd bought it in the 70s for my dad.
Yes, go on, Maximum Denim. Yes.
Maximum Denim has put in another £27 million into the club. So, you know, his total investment is well into about £130 million. And even though Bournemouth had a very good innings in the Premier League, they only made a profit in 1 year out of, I think, the six or seven that they were there, which is indicative of just how tough it is to survive in the Premier League. So many people fall into the trap that once you're there, it's going to be a real gravy train for the owners, but that's not necessarily the case.
So this £75 million loss, that's including the parachute payment from falling out of the Premier League, is it?
No, that's for last season. So that's 20. So that is their
season in the Premier League. I see. Oh crikey! Of course it was. Yes, blimey, they lost that money in the Premier. That's interesting. And why of all the other clubs you mentioned has Guy specifically wanted us to mention Cambridge United?
Well, again, Cambridge United is not a club that gets a lot of credit, but yeah, at the same time, it lost over three. Yeah, and we're talking far fewer zeros. But it doesn't matter. It's the old Mr. McCorber comment, isn't it? It all depends upon which side of the divide you're on. They lost £346,000 in the year, and somebody's got to write out a cheque, in effect, to cover those losses. So it does look as if they're managing to get through. Clearly, this season they will be in receipt of money from the Premier League £50 million grant package. But regardless of the division, so many clubs are reporting losses for 2019-20. And remember that the sport was only impacted in terms of COVID from March to June during that season. So, you know, it's the figures for this year are going to be eye-wateringly painful.
Yes, well, we won't look forward to that. Now, I don't often get to say this, Kieran, but we have news from the National Cyber Security Centre. I'm afraid the Baroness has accessed your internet history. And it seems from the National Cyber Security Centre that West Ham may have leaked some fans' details. That's quite serious, this breach, is it?
The NSCS, or whatever it calls itself, it puts out a weekly report, and somehow some strange stuff arrives in my inbox from strange places, quite often Russia. When am I coming back? And I delete that before the Baroness catches that one. But this is in respect of West Ham's website. And apparently, if you went onto the website as a fan, it allowed people to see the names, addresses, date of birth, phone numbers, and email addresses of other fans. Now, you know, West Ham fans are... Yeah, they wouldn't be interested in that. But it only needs one person with an ulterior motive, and all of a sudden you've got some pretty useful information, which can then be used for shenanigans and ulterior purposes. But it does sort of, you know, ask first of all, why on earth did this happen? The club did an investigation. It was an internal error. It's now been addressed. But football, along with sadly many other institutions, is the target for cyber attacks. We've seen the NHS, we've seen Manchester United, who had all of their email addresses impossible to access for a few weeks, and somebody was trying to get £5 million off them. There was a report that another Premier League club ended up potentially having to pay out to these scumbags. And it's indicative of where we are today, in that you can be a criminal from your bedroom.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of unpleasant people out there. I know at university we've had to upgrade our defences because you're never quite sure. And you know, we're doing research into some very sensitive areas. You know, not the nonsense that I teach. It's, you know, I've got colleagues who are proper boffins, if you know what I mean. You know, the people doing the stuff on astrophysics and research on you know, vaccines and things of that nature. And we've got some fantastic people that I work with, and we've got to protect them.
Yeah, I shouldn't think high-profile West Ham fans like Danny Dyer or James Corden would be that happy about the notion that their contact details could be leaked. There's no indication, for example, that personal bank account details or anything like that were revealed?
Not from what I've seen on the NSCS website. So yeah, that's at least one thing. I mean, I presume, like me, you probably get two or three calls a day from people claiming to be from the National Insurance Bureau, and they're going to close down your account, or from Amazon or from Microsoft, and it is just getting pretty relentless. And you know, how these people get through to punters like us is something which is baffling. But the telecommunications industry seems to take a fairly relaxed approach to it.
I ordered something from Fatface 3 Christmases ago for Ali. Didn't fit, as it happened. But I'd probably get an email from them on a, you know, 3 times a week basis offering me bobble hats, socks, that sort of thing. But we had a rather plaintive one last week saying that they'd had a breach of their security, and it was possible that bank details had been leaked, but not seriously enough to make me have to change my bank account, which was fine. Good luck accessing that. But if a football club were to release details of that sort, accidentally bank details, and people then had to change accounts because of it, would the club be liable for any costs that may occur in doing that?
Potentially, yeah. There could either be a class action suit, or it could be that the regulators of things of this nature would prosecute or fine the institution. And yeah, we're talking far beyond football clubs here for lax lacks control over sensitive information. Yeah, we do have, what was it called, GDPR or whatever it's called. And it does mean that people have had to up their game, but it's a constant case of chase up with the scumbags.
Yeah, well, also, I imagine these databases would be worth quite a lot of money to some companies, wouldn't they, for marketing purposes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the future of football is data based. Yeah. Manchester United, who claim to have 1,100 million followers around the world. Well, if they can get even, 10 or 20% of those people to sign up for the Manchester United app, and then they can, of course, they can use cookies to follow them. They've got an awful lot of information, which is of value, and data is going to be as valuable for the next 20 or 30 years as oil has been for the last 50 or 60.
Oh, well, let's not discourage people from joining our Patreons club, whatever it is. We promise you, everybody, that we will not use your data to access specific information about what sort of mugs you like. Oh, dear, I've given it away. It's looking likely, Kieran, hurrah, that some fans will be able to attend the FA Cup semi-final.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yes, this is an intriguing story because it looks as if this is going to be a sort of a test match for one of the semi-finals only.
Oh, okay.
Which does seem a bit confusing. I've looked at the comments from Oliver Dowden, and his comments are, it's a case of, can we ensure that we can set up one-way systems, have proper ventilation, look for the pinch points in terms of when people are coming to and from the ground, and looking at the number of interactions. So what the government wants to do is to effectively say, if we've got, I think it's, it could be 10,000 people turning up at the match, are they going to behave in a suitably socially distanced manner that we can then start to release the gates in terms of who can attend. Yeah. The FA are confident that there will be 20,000 people attending the final for the FA Cup. And we've also heard that the Premier League, which has now shifted one set of midweek matches to the last week of the season, so every club in the Premier League will now be hosting one game in front of fans. There's even talk about away fans attending those matches as well, which I guess as a fan, you've got mixed feelings about, because there's so many clubs that have had fans who have either delayed taking refunds or have everybody's been very patient, and when we did have tiers 2 and 3 and so on in November and December. It meant that some fans didn't get to see their clubs play and others did, which seems a little bit harsh. Having away fans will add another layer of progress, I guess, to where we hope to be at some point in the sense of full stadiums and enjoying football for the reasons why we fell in love with it in the first place.
That's an intriguing one, that, Kieran. We should keep an eye on it, because I know, for example, at Selhurst Park, we're allowed 6,500 people in, which is 25%. There'll be no shortage of Palace fans who want to take those tickets. I don't think they'd be too happy if 500 Arsenal fans were there and quite a few Palace season tickets weren't able to attend. Do we know which semi-final it's going to be? Have they decided?
As yet, no. I think Leicester fans will be desperate to get there.
Of course.
Because it will be a big day out. That's not, no disrespect to Leicester, but getting to Wembley for an FA Cup semi-final means more to Leicester fans than it does to Manchester United and City and Chelsea. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, do you know what? I reckon it's probably Newcastle complaining again, because they were so unhappy about the idea of Fulham having fans in for that last game of the season, weren't they? Which is a potential relegation decider. They're probably the club that have put their foot down and said there has to be away fans. You can't blame them, to be perfectly honest. But we'll keep an eye on it. It would seem a shame, though, Kieran, if fans have won one of the semi-final teams could go. And what about the Carabao Cup? Because there was talk that there were the fans in as well, wouldn't it, for the final?
Yes. In terms of the Carabao Cup, the EFL, I understand, are confident that there will be a limited number of fans. And, you know, you'd want something to be taking place. Spurs fans, again, it's 2008 since they last won a trophy. I think it's the only one that they've won this century. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm gonna say yes, Kieran. Yes, it is, I believe. Yes. Yeah.
So, they deserve a chance to see. I guess they've been to the Champions League final as well. But yeah, it's the only domestic thing that they've achieved.
Yeah, for a club that hasn't won the title since 1961, they certainly are quite entitled, aren't they, their fans? The European Clubs Association and UEFA are at loggerheads over the future of the Champions League. And this seems to be a story that changes on a daily basis, Kieran. And this is to do with the 10-game group stage, is it?
Well, the format of the Champions League going forwards from 2024-25, that appears to be done and dusted. So this is our legendary Swiss model. And I was looking into it in a bit more depth, as I tend to do with models. And it starts off with 36 teams.
It's not 1977, Kieran. Sadly. Yes.
It starts off with 36 teams who are going to play 180 games in order to reduce the competition down from 36 to 24.
Wow.
Yeah, that's progress, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the clubs who are 9th to 24th, they have a playoff to find out who gets into the last 16, and then it goes forwards from there. So, it's an awful lot of football to not make very much progress. What happens if you are, 18th and you're playing the club which are 21st and it's two matches to go? There's going to be an awful lot of dead rubbers.
Sorry, Ken. I left a pause as I assumed there was going to be another 1976.
Should I hand this one across to you?
Yeah, I thought we were going to be ending up under the pier of Brighton Beach there, but it does all beg. I mean, I've researched this, Kieran, and it does beg the question why. And we're not the only people asking that. Steve Parish, chairman of Crystal Palace, second oldest football club in the league. Speaking of the expansion plans in the Daily Mail yesterday, said most clubs don't want them, most fans don't want them, and broadcasters aren't asking for them. So, and of course, UEFA would say, well, he's talking about a club that will never be part of those plans, I imagine. But it does beg the question, who does want this expanded league?
Well, we now move on to the coup d'etat, as it appears to be, between the European Clubs Association, which in theory represents 220 clubs in Europe, in practice probably represents about 15 to 20, versus UEFA and the leagues themselves. So it's a real power battle. The big clubs, as we know where we stand. They want more money. They want more certainty. So the battle appears to be between these clubs who think that finishing seventh in the Premier League is sufficient to get you into a competition called the Champions League. So that's what could potentially happen. And we talk about clubs, and I think we have to be careful here, because when I talk to my friends, you know, I teach at the University of Liverpool. I've lived in Manchester most of my life. United fans and Liverpool fans say, well, if we don't finish in the top four, we don't deserve it. And we don't, you know, it's up to us to get our act together. So there is no desire coming from the fan base. So who are we talking about? We're talking about club owners. Do the Glazers, does John Henry at FSG actually give a hoot about football? They don't. We're dealing with money people, and money people focus on bottom line, and the Champions League is very lucrative. So everything is stacked towards these clubs, because the league saying, well, if there's an extra four places going into this new competition or this new format of the competition, why can't that go to the winners of the Dutch League or the winners of the Scottish Premiership or things? And that would be, yeah, it would be fantastic if they did. And then the owners of Manchester United and Liverpool say, well, hold on, you know, we might not finish in the top four, and it's going to cost us money, and you know, and we're entitled to be there. And you know, you talk about, you mentioned entitlement before. Entitlement from club owners is a very distressing thing. So we've now got effectively the Premier League and the Bundesliga on one side, and individual clubs from the Premier League and the Bundesliga against the leagues for which they represent. So yeah, I don't know where we go. And I did have a thing and say, well, hold on. Yeah, perhaps I'm just being too old fashioned in this. Now here's a suggestion, and I'm going to contract Agnelli at Juve, because he's unhappy that his club has recently been booted out of the Champions League by, I think it was, Lyon, Porto and Ajax. Yeah, those clubs don't deserve to be there. How about this? The club that has the most Instagram followers before the match gets a goal head start. And that means if you're a proper, you know, if you're a Manchester United fan in Arkansas called, you know, Dwight D. Schmuckelberger III or something, you say, well, I can't be at the match, but by liking the club on Instagram, I'm helping my club. I think that's the way forwards.
You could be on a winner now. I've got another idea, Kieran, which is where the champions of each league in Europe go into a cup competition and play each other. And if you get knocked out, you get knocked out. Simple as that. But
That's radical, that is, Kevin.
It's hopelessly modern, isn't it? And of course, the money people you talk about, because they have a lot of money, they don't realise the money it takes for fans to attend those extra games either, do they? That's the thing. It's all very well saying there's going to be, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8 extra group games. That's what the fans want. But they don't, because they can't afford it. It's as simple as that.
Yep. Yeah. And the impact this will have on domestic football is you how can you fit in? And they're talking about it will only be an extra four match weeks or whatever they call. But if you're a club in the Premier League, you're not allowed to play on the dates when the UEFA matches take place. So yeah, what happens if you've got a replay? Well, there won't be any replays because there won't be any cups. The Carabao Cup is very, very much at risk for this. As I understand it, the FA Cup, apart from the third round, will move to a midweek competition. And that is a tragedy, because for any, you know, I can remember Exeter City and Crawley being away at Old Trafford. And it was, you know, the whole town decamps. And it's something which is memorable. And that surely does count. But I guess, you know, again, we're looking at it from the wrong point of view. We've got this silly notion that it's fans that should be at the heartbeat of football, and the owners are thinking it's them.
Yeah. Here's another radical idea, Kieran. I think all the teams that win the FA Cups in their respective countries should go into a cup tournament and call it the Cup Winners' Cup. How about that as an idea?
You're wasted on this podcast, Kevin.
I should be in marketing of some sort, shouldn't I? Also, what intrigues me, Kieran, and this is mainly anecdotal, as I haven't seen the figures on this, although there is some suggestion that they would back me up, is that the fact that there's been games virtually every night of the week during the COVID pandemic has shown that there's no real appetite for more football on TV from fans. So this notion that the broadcasters would be rubbing their hands together with glee because there's going to be an extra game. Yeah, no, I don't know anybody who watches the UEFA games on a Europa Cup games on a Thursday night unless they support the team involved. It's beyond me. This is a very odd story, this one, Kieran. I believe it's our first ever trip to Pakistan, but the Pakistan football headquarters has been attacked, with one official saying that he was forced to hand over the accounts and the checkbook.
Yes, this is actually a quite distressing story.
Yeah.
Pakistan were banned by FIFA in 2015, and the reason why they were banned was due to political interference in the game, terms of the chief executive of the Pakistan Football Federation was appointed by a court, and that court was itself appointed by people within the politics of Pakistan, and so that cost Pakistan progress, and then we made a little bit of we moved ourselves forward a bit. And FIFA relinquished the ban, and they had a guy called Haroon Malik, who was the chair of the PFF, and I think it was on Saturday night. It was effectively, they were stormed by the former chief executive, who was effectively held to ransom. Again, it was, I said the words coup d'etat once today, so I might as well say it twice. He was forced to hand over the checkbook and things of this nature. The Pakistan Women's Championship was due to take place in Karachi this weekend, and Pakistan women's football, it's trying to progress, but the competition got cancelled because nobody knew what was happening. I suspect that FIFA will now reawaken itself in terms of monitoring what's happening in Pakistan, and then there's a genuine chance that they will go back to the position they took in 2015 and said this coup d'etat appears to be government sanctioned, and therefore we want to keep a modicum of political interference in football away from the game, and we're going to ban you again. So it's the other side of the world, and Pakistan is more of a cricket country than a football country. But this is absolutely appalling behaviour.
Yeah, it's one of those, Pakistan and India, the countries that you kind of hope don't ever start taking football seriously, because they've got such enormous populations, and you imagine a huge depth of sporting talent if they were to take football seriously. And that is a distressing story, and it's one we'll keep an eye on. And the Chinese FA has disqualified six of their clubs from taking part in professional football next season because of financial problems. It takes a lot for a league to disqualify its own clubs, doesn't it?
It does, except in China. I mean, the league is due to start, I think, on the 20th of April, and I think matches are taking place in bubbles. Now, we have spoken about the Chinese Super League champions Jiangsu, who effectively were liquidated themselves. They just disappeared off the face of the earth in February. But the Chinese Football Federation has banned or effectively disqualified three clubs in Division 2, including Taozhou Yuanda, and that's as far as I'm going to go with my pronunciations, two more clubs in the third division, and this is due to a lack of financial control. They've also introduced a significant wage cap in the Super League because the football authorities have decided that they don't particularly want to be associated with conspicuous consumption in the form of too much of a bling environment in football, but also the clubs were losing money. And I thought, six clubs being disqualified, that doesn't look too great. But I read the full sort of press release, and they said, we're really pleased that it's only six clubs compared to 2020 when it was 16. So, I think this should be a good news story rather than a bad one.
Well, it's not that long ago, is it, that Chinese football was thought to be awash with money. It became a bit of a cliche that somebody virtually 3 years running, we thought Benteke would be off to China to take advantage of the £600,000 a week wages or whatever you believed was available. So it hasn't taken long for that bubble to burst, has it?
That's right. And it's due to a change, I think, in the political ethos of China. China is very keen to host a World Cup. I think it is looking potentially at 2030, but might have to be 2034 because, you know, Qatar is perhaps too close from a confederation's perspective.
Yeah.
But initially, I think the viewpoint was by investing an awful lot of money in European clubs, they could pick up tips in terms of training and coaching and things of that nature. That didn't seem to work. Then, well, let's bring the players to China. And that didn't seem to work because it tended to be players not necessarily at the height of their career, perhaps on the downside. The Chinese government felt, this doesn't look good. This is not how we want to portray ourselves, as just throwing money around willy-nilly, because that sort of is clearly inconsistent with the communist ethos of the country.
Yeah.
So now it's contracted its expansion. Because it was only, I think it was only in 2018 that the Chinese Super League spent more money in one of the transfer windows than the Premier League did.
Yeah,
and everybody
goes,
oh, jeepers, creepers. Yeah, this is serious competition. There's still a huge desire to host the World Cup, but the philosophy in China is very different because, the nation does have the one-child policy, and I work in education, and education is taken very, very seriously over there. So whereas here, in England, if one of your kids is progressing and gets the chance to go to academy for a football club, everybody's made up. Perhaps in China, they're thinking, well, is this going to take my child away from an opportunity to go to university, to go into an engineering? Football doesn't have necessarily the same cultural position in China than it does in England.
That's interesting. Before we go, Kieran, a big thank you to those of you who've already signed up to become patrons of our pod. We only started it on Sunday, so that's very impressive. And that list includes James Cruden, Martin Scholar, Peter Keeley, Andy Hunter, Andy Stone, Matt, John McSherry, Swiss Ramble, not really, Mahesh McCarney, Kevin Moore, Nobby Clark, hello Nobby, Stephen, Mike McCarthy, Joe Haining, Tom McCall, great name, Will Frapple, Graham Nealon, Christopher Saunders, and Chris Hayward. Women don't listen to this pod, Kieran, do they? If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution in return for mentions and stuff, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And don't worry, we will always be free to air. But any of your donations would be most welcome, because Guy needs a new sofa. And of course, if you want to ask us any questions about the world of football, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And I shall hand you over to Kieran Maguire of Liverpool University for his traditional trademark farewell.
Well, thanks for all the great stuff as usual, folks. We do have feedback. We do love the fact that that Guy, the producer, does now appear to have metamorphosed into the Stig from Top Gear.
It's amazing. He's got a fan club. He's so pleased with himself as well. It's shameful watching a normally modest man going, it's just a bit of fun, isn't it? I'm sure they like you two as well as they like me.
And just also, just a reminder that next Wednesday, we will be recording with Neil Doncaster, the head of the SPFL. So if you have any specific questions in relation to Scottish football, please send them in to questions@priceoffootball.com. And if you could mark them Scotland, then produce a guy when he's not saving the world and stopping trains and rescuing women from burning skyscrapers, he will put them into the right pile.
Yeah, I can imagine Guy in a cape. I don't know what his superhero name would be. Perhaps we could ask our patrons for suggestions. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. the price of football.